It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll find out why the avocado has risen to superstar status in American food and the problems that's creating for producers.
First, the Toma Veterans Affairs Hospital announced a 30-day plan this week to improve operations. The announcement comes after months of allegations that the center was overprescribing opiates to veterans, leading to patient death, and that administrators retaliated against whistleblowers on the staff.
The plan is aimed at improving communication and relationships between veterans and VA staff, but some politicians already say it isn't going far enough.
Aaron Glantz joins us now. He's the veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, who initially broke the story back in January. Aaron, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So as you see it, Aaron, how big a step is this plan in restoring the credibility and the image of the Toma VA?
I'd say overall, this is a pretty insignificant development. Basically, the VA announced that they're going to have a bunch of meetings over the next month to improve morale and care. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners have worked for organizations where their company had a lot of meetings, and sometimes it's helpful, but usually it's not. That doesn't mean that the VA isn't moving to solve these problems, but I think sometimes they get a little carried away with their press releases.
Well, they're billing them as listening sessions, and I guess that's a good sign that they're receptive to hearing what people have to say. What do you think could come out of a listening session like that?
You know, I'm not sure. One of the problems that existed at the Toma VA before was this culture of retaliatory management that the chief of staff of the hospital, David Houlihan, he's the psychiatrist that was referred to as the candy man because he was so quick to dole out the narcotics to veterans, and he's currently being investigated by the Drug Enforcement Administration, by the VA itself, and by the state of Wisconsin for his prescription practices, and he was one of the physicians who was responsible for the death in the psychiatric ward of a former Marine in August of last year. He's been removed, so that's good. His boss, the head of the hospital, Mario DeSantis, who you know, in a lot of the reporting seemed to be kind of out to lunch to all these problems, he's also been removed from his post. One of the psychiatrists on the psychiatric ward who's being investigated in connection with the death, Dr. Rhonda Davis, she's been removed. So a lot of the people who have been implicated directly in the scandal have been removed. The VA is continuing to investigate the situation, so they're still getting paid your tax dollars in the meantime, but they're not treating any veterans. And the new person, who used to be in Madison, who was put in to head the Toma VA on an interim basis, as you mentioned, is now holding these meetings. So, you know, it's certainly not a bad thing, but how good is it? Only time will tell.
Now, what you were getting at there was a sense that the VA needs a culture change in this Toma facility. What would a culture change look like? You mentioned the removal of some top officials who may have been contributing to the culture there. So what else needs to happen to have a culture change?
Well, I mean, I think that the accountability is really key in the VA, not just in Toma and Wisconsin, but nationally. It's a big problem. There's so many people at the VA who really care about veterans, who are trying to do a great job for people who are coming home from war, who've dedicated their lives to you know, helping people make this transition. And then you have people like Dr. Houlihan, whose medical practices seem to really hurt veterans. And I think the number one thing that people are looking for, both at the hospital itself, in the community, and then in Washington, is they're looking to see how the accountability will be dealt with. And that will also send a message to the people who work at the hospital now. Let them know that if they do a good job treating veterans, if they help veterans stay healthy and recover from war, that they'll get promoted and raises and generally be treated well. And that on the other hand, if you know, if they fail veterans, if they hand out like narcotics, like their candy, if they deliver substandard care that results in deaths, that they'll face punishment. And I think that's the number one thing that people are looking for. The VA has done a number of things in response to all the scrutiny that have kind of indicated that they're looking towards holding people accountable. But, you know, we're still waiting for the other shoe to drop here.
Now, other parts of the plan, as reported by Wisconsin Public Radio, an ethics fair and an emphasis on improving the relationship between the staff's union leaders and medical center management. Do those things, do you think, perhaps equal an effort toward greater accountability like you're describing the need for?
Well, I think that the increased communication with the union is a very important step because one of the things that we uncovered in our investigation is that for years, the union, which is representing the dedicated, you know, nurses, psychologists, other people who provide direct service to veterans, were bringing these concerns to the hospital management, bringing their concerns also to their congressmen and senators, bringing their concerns to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and that every time they would try to get the attention of folks and say, hey, there's a big problem here, they would just be brushed aside and ignored. And it wasn't until everything blew up in the media that politicians and VA officials began to pay attention. So if the VA is making an effort to improve relations with the union, it also means that they're increasing efforts to listen to the healthcare providers who treat veterans when they say there might be a problem. And I'd say that's probably a good thing.
We're talking with Aaron Glantz right now, veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting, talking about the Tomah VA Hospital's 30-day plan to try and improve operations. And Aaron, what do we know about political reaction to this 30-day plan so far?
You know, Senator Ron Johnson, you know, who he, as you know, chairs the Senate Oversight Committee, which has been looking into this from an investigatory point of view since we broke the story back in January. He said it's basically too little, too late. You know, I think other politicians are, you know, they have more of a wait and see attitude. I have noticed that there has been an increasing amount of legislation proposed in Washington that's designed to fix this problem. Congressman Ron Kind has a number of bills, most of which have been co-sponsored with other members of the delegation. So I think that I'd say that the politicians are on it. I'd say that the VA is on it. I've been pretty impressed that, you know, the different powerful factions in the story, be it the administration or the politicians from the Democrat or the Republican Party, that they haven't let it go as an issue, even as it kind of recedes from the front page of the paper. All parties seem interested in solving the problem, but this development of the 30-day plan is not really the end of the story. We're still kind of in the middle of it.
Now, you mentioned Senator Ron Johnson saying effectually too little, too late. He's also pointed to concern that PTSD treatment has not been addressed in the plan. Do you know anything more about what his concerns are there?
You know, one of the things that we've noticed, not just in Tomah, but across the country, is that these narcotics are frequently being prescribed to people with mental health issues. And this is absolutely contrary to the VA's own regulations. So just so your listeners understand, narcotic painkillers, so these are opiates, they're similar to heroin, morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, which is the generic form of Vicodin. They basically are designed to make you not feel that much physical pain. And they're also highly addictive and you know, can lead to suicide and overdose amongst people with mental health conditions. One of the things that's a problem at the VA is that even though the VA regulations say that doctors should be especially conservative in prescribing these medications to people with mental health problems, that in fact those are the very people who are getting more of these drugs than anyone else. And another problem is that The VA is prescribing a lot of these drugs, not just Entoma nationally. They told a congressional hearing earlier this year 100,000 veterans nationwide are receiving not only opiate painkillers, but they're receiving it at the same time that they're receiving these muscle relaxants and tranquilizers called benzodiazepines, like Valium and Xanax, for example. That also puts people at a risk for overdose. And again, these are people frequently with mental health conditions. So, you know, everyone wants to know, is the VA, both Entoma and nationally, going to be able to roll out treatments that are effective in treating these conditions that they know exist and that they sometimes make available, or are they going to continue to rely far too much on these extremely powerful and abusable medications?
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was Aaron Glanz, veterans reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. He joined us to talk about the Toma VA Hospital's 30-day plan to try and improve operations. First, we're taking a closer look at the fruit that's taken America by storm in recent years, the avocado. At one point, avocados were specialty food, but now they're big business. It's estimated that Americans ate about 4.25 billion avocados just last year. And in a telling sign of the times, the industry organization Avocados from Mexico actually ran a Super Bowl ad this year.
So it's fair to say Americans can't get enough of the little green fruit, but it's coming at a cost. That's according to our next guest, who says avocados are on an unstable trajectory, and it's causing problems for farmers in Mexico and here at home.
So what do we need to know about the avocado before enjoying that next helping of guacamole on our burrito? Well, Dan Stone is here with us now to tell us. He's a reporter for National Geographic who's been covering what's been going on with avocados. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Veronica.
Dan, just how popular are avocados right now?
More popular than ever. As you said in your intro, 4.25 billion avocados. If you think about how many Americans there are, just over 300 million, that's a lot of avocados. And the growth is pretty staggering. For the past 5 years, avocado consumption has risen between 10 and 30% every year, which is one reason why the price of avocados in your supermarket has also risen, because the supply cannot keep up with that rate of demand.
Now, this wasn't always the case. When I was growing up, people were not nuts about avocados the way they are right now. What changed? What's driving it?
Well, a few things. One you mentioned was a marketing campaign, which marketing doesn't affect everything we buy, but it certainly helps. The other thing is avocados, over the past 3 years, earned this elusive title of a superfood. And we've heard it attached to other foods before, acai berries, quinoa, right? These indigenous foods in parts of the world, usually Central and South America, that have existed for centuries, millennia, grown by indigenous people, suddenly they're found to be extra attractive for their nutritional qualities. In avocados' case, it's for their healthy monounsaturated fats and their oils. And so once you become a superfood, they start flying off the shelves, and the indigenous people who grow these crops and have for so long suddenly have to keep up with demand and really tax their land because of the high dollar amounts their crops can demand.
I want to talk a little bit more about avocado history, and then we'll get into more of what's going on right now. But for one thing, the avocado is a berry. Who knew? I had no idea that the avocado was a berry. But can you give us a little bit more about the history of the avocado?
Sure. The avocado botanically is a fruit, and it is a berry under that classification. Berries are just something that a plant does to attract something to eat it, because fruits want their seeds to be eaten and then excreted somewhere else so that they can grow. With strawberries, you have little birds that are attracted to the little to the sweet red flesh. With avocados, the species that used to eat avocados has been extinct for about 2 million years. They were these large elephant-like creatures called gomphotheres, very large, like mammoths, and they would eat the avocados whole. And you know how big those seeds are, so they can eat and digest one of those seeds whole, and then poop it out somewhere else to grow new avocado trees. When they went extinct, these big elephant-like creatures, the avocados found a way to endure for 2 million more years, and that's why we still have them today. But there really is no botanical requirement for avocados to still exist.
Hmm. Well, so you pointed out, you know, that this is not entirely a good news story. Avocados are tasty. I'm glad they're around. But it seems as though the boom right now is not necessarily a great thing for avocado producers in Mexico, where most avocados come from. Can you tell us a little bit more about why this is not always a good news story?
Sure, absolutely. More avocados come from Mexico than anywhere in the world. The U.S. and Indonesia both produce some, but Mexico produces about 10 times more. It takes a lot of water to produce avocados. We've heard a lot about almonds, chickpeas in the past few weeks with the drought in California. Avocados aren't far behind. To give you an idea, it takes about 100 gallons of water to produce a pound of avocados, and that's two avocados generally to a pound. So it's about 50 gallons of water per avocado. That's about filling your bathtub up every time you want to eat an avocado. And for these farmers in parts of Mexico, water is not plentiful. It is not flowing in the way that it can be consistent. So what they're doing is having to find new sources of water to tap wells at higher and higher altitudes, and really in an unsustainable way. What they're finding is because you and I are paying $1 to $1.50 per avocado, that is too valuable to delay. They want to do whatever they can with their land, and it taxes it very, very hard. The other side is with organized crime in Mexico. We've heard of these drug cartels that deal with hard drugs, cocaine and heroin. In recent years, because of the elusiveness of some of these top-tier foods, I'm talking about avocados, and particularly limes also, these cartels have gotten into the business of trafficking these crops, and that provides them an actual legal product that they can use to extort money from farmers.
And so I read in your piece that some of these cartels refer to avocados and maybe limes as green gold.
Oro verde, exactly. They use this as a tool, and they don't have to get their hands on as many hard drugs as they used to because avocados are ubiquitous. They're part of the culture, and they've been around forever.
We're talking right now with Dan Stone from National Geographic. He's talking about America's love affair with the avocado and why it might not be such a good thing and why demand may outstrip supply as well. And we're talking about the water use that's involved in avocados, 100 gallons of water for about two avocados, roughly. So what does that mean as we look at drought issues in California, some avocados produced there? And also, should we be having guacamole guilt at this point?
That wouldn't be a bad idea, but good luck with that. I don't think many people feel guilty about guacamole. What we've seen in California is that some of these farmers, when they're really taxed with their water usage, they are shifting some of the crops from water-intensive crops like avocados, chickpeas, and almonds to less water-intensive ones, grapes, tomatoes, and even some tubers and citrus. In a place like Mexico, it's a harder equation because avocados are so central to the agricultural economy. You know, I think what the future will be is agricultural research, finding an avocado variety, a new type of seed that can grow with less water, perhaps in less rich soil and in more erratic climates. And that's going to take some research from agribusiness companies and from avocado breeders. That will take time. It will also take money. And I think a lot of the money for that research will be passed along to consumers like you and me.
Now, is the kind of avocado that we get from California or Florida the same as the one we get from Mexico?
The main avocado we eat is called the Haas avocado. We've all heard of that one. That mainly comes out of Mexico and California. Florida grows a different avocado that you've maybe seen. It's got a very smooth skin and a deep, dark brown color. That avocado is also eaten, but it's the Haas that's considered the global celebrity.
And in terms of those scientific advances you're hoping for that may help breed a less water-intensive avocado, is there a hot spot? Are there people who are actively working on this right now?
A lot of the work and research is being done in California. The Haas Avocado Board is in California, and a lot of these farmers have the money and the industry backing, especially with the high price of avocados, to do that research. You know, this is agricultural research that gets done with all sorts of crops, how to make rice that can grow in floods and in droughts, how to grow corn in different soil conditions. Avocados will find a way to adapt, but I don't think it'll be quick, and it certainly won't be cheap for those of us who enjoy them.
Now, we've got, as you said, a little bit of domestic avocado production going on, Florida and California. Is it possible that those regions could just step up to meet the demand for avocados?
Well, both of those regions have their own demands and their own problems, certainly with water in California. You know, California is one of the richest agricultural areas on the planet. Avocados are, fortunately and unfortunately, a tropical fruit. So you're really looking at parts of Southern California, parts of Southern Florida, and maybe parts of Hawaii to really grow it. But, you know, in an agricultural economy that is now increasingly global, does it make sense to grow more in California, or does it make sense to investigate perhaps ways that they could be grown in Indonesia or China or in some of the Pacific Islands where both labor and agricultural conditions are more favorable?
And Dan, just briefly as we wrap up, if an avocado, if you see it as an issue of social responsibility, should we be buying avocados from a particular region, only from the United States or from a particular region of Mexico? How do we buy responsibly?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, as much as these farmers and this land is taxed in California and in Mexico, you know, the avocado craze really is creating a market. It's creating a very lucrative market for people who might not otherwise have that income. So overall, yeah, we should be eating as many fresh fruits and vegetables as farmers can produce. And Mexico, California, it doesn't matter quite as much as we're providing a market for this to exist and an incentive for these crops to be grown perhaps elsewhere in the world to cash in on a lot of this.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. One almost universal in human history is that people in countries around the world seem to be really prone to a sweet tooth.
From rugala in Eastern Europe to mochi in Japan, tres leches cake in Mexico, and, of course, American apple pie, sugar leaves a cultural imprint wherever you go. Over the centuries, it's also inspired jaw-dropping art and spurred technological advances.
Yet there are parts of sugar's history that are bittersweet. Over the past centuries, its story detours through slavery and environmental degradation to its role in a lot of health problems.
Joining us now is Dara Goldstein, a food writer and founding editor of Gastronomica, the Journal of Food and Culture. She's the editor of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. Dara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm glad to be talking to you.
So there is a lot to say, obviously, about sugar, a lot to know. This anthology is 900 pages long. Why devote so much space to the topic of sugar and sweets?
You know, it's fascinating. I see the book, having worked on it for so long, as really a compendium of human desire, human pleasure, and human pain. It encompasses our evolution, history and culture, and all through the lens of the sweet. When I think about, there's really, it's hard to think of another foodstuff that has had so much impact on civilization.
Well, what is it about sugar that makes it so attractive to us humans?
Well, it started out just with our evolution. Foods that were ripe and that had a sweet taste were almost assuredly not going to be toxic. So we developed this taste for the sweet and an aversion to the bitter. And that taste, once we had more access to sweet things, it just kept burgeoning. But it also, in the early years, sugar was seen as a medicine, and it was prescribed as such. I mean, it's been a total shift when you think about how we consider it today.
These days, we talk about sugar sometimes in the language of addiction. Do we know what happens in the brain when the brain experiences sugar?
It's fascinating. Sugar itself is not inherently addictive, but it's the refining process that causes the problem. So you can think by analogy of the coca leaf that produces cocaine when it's very highly refined and turned into this powder. If you take a fresh coca leaf and you brew some tea with it, you get a nice little buzz, but it's not dangerous. But the highly refined form of it goes right to the brain, and there are the pathways that it takes to our pleasure receptors. And the same sort of thing happens with sugar. So if you nibble on some sugar cane, if you've ever done that, it's quite lovely, but you're not going to get ill from that. But if you have white sugar and have teaspoonful after teaspoonful, it's going to start doing some damage.
So our natural desire to eat sugar wouldn't be so bad if we were just picking the occasional fruit off the tree to get our sweetness fix. But that desire plus a world, a marketplace packed with refined sugar products, that's where we start to run into trouble?
Yes, that's really what the issue is. And this didn't happen until pretty much the late 19th century with industrialization and also the discovery of processing beets for sugar. It became much less expensive to be able to get sugar, and then it started flooding the marketplace and becoming much cheaper.
And these days we're talking about a world where sugar is almost considered a vice, but was there a time when it was really considered more of a virtue?
Yes, it did start out as a medicine. If you look at Ayurvedic medicine in India or in China, where in both cases it was seen as a substance that created warmth and heat for the body and also encouraged fluidity so that all of your juices were flowing well. And this continued into Western culture as well through humoral medicine, where sugar was often prescribed for people who were phlegmatic or who were not feeling well. So over the centuries, it was used as comfits, which is a word that I love. I would love for it to be brought back into contemporary usage in English. But these are the kinds of seeds like caraway or fennel. You know, when you go to an Indian restaurant and you have sugar-coated seeds at the end, that goes right back to the idea of a little bit of sugar and these spices, and it's very good for the digestion.
We're talking with Dara Goldstein about the history and culture of sugar and sweets. And Dara, speaking of medicine, there's an entry in the book about something called a sugar of lead that was used medicinally.
Oh, yes. Well, it's really kind of crazy because that was the 19th century, what turned out to be rather a quack medicine because it contained lead. And it didn't really contain sugar. It just had a very sweet flavor. And so it was often prescribed for people with stomach problems until they realized that it was causing more problems than not.
Do we know when sugar began to be popularized? When you would think of not just the ruling classes, but the average person had access to sugar and what it tasted like to them then?
Yeah, I think that the best case for us to understand is looking at late 19th century England. And you could look at Sidney Mintz's wonderful book, Sweetness and Power, and he wrote the introduction to this Oxford Companion. And he looked at the drop in sugar prices and how suddenly what had been this incredible luxury item for the affluent and aristocrats who had beautiful, beautiful constructions made out of sugar to decorate their tables. Suddenly, they were able to put sugar into their tea. They could use sugar to have jam. It is a wonderful preservative, and so that was a way of keeping fruits fresh. And then they started to feel that they were having a taste of luxury as well. But if you track the health of the working classes in England from the time they started imbibing more sugar because they were drinking a lot of tea, their health really began to suffer from it because it gives the satisfaction, and they didn't feel that they needed to eat as many other things because they were feeling more satisfied from the sugar.
That's the downside on the consumer side. As we mentioned up front there, there was also a big downside on the producer side. Slavery in the history of sugar production and even post-slavery, poor working conditions up to this day, as I understand it.
Yeah, it's really one of the things that was important to me in putting together this volume was to revel in the pleasure and the delight that the sweet brings to us, but not to forget the dark side of it because when I said earlier that sugar has to do with the rise of civilization, then slavery, unfortunately, is a real case in point. In the United States, we tend to think of slavery. slaves on cotton plantations, but worldwide many more were employed in growing sugar cane, and it was really brutal work because those canes have very, very sharp fibers. And there were also dangers with working in the refineries when there could be explosions. And even after slavery ended, a lot of children were employed in candy factories. I'm in Chicago at the moment, and Chicago is home to Cracker Jacks, which, you know, are this wonderful, iconic American candy. But in the early 20th century, it was found that they were employing children to make candy. And today the big problem is in places like Ivory Coast and Ghana, where very small children are sent out to harvest cacao, the pods that eventually turn into the chocolate that we know. So it's still an issue that's with us.
And you referred earlier to sugar being sort of the delight of the elite. And could you talk about how it was used sort of more whimsically as we go along?
Yes. Beautiful, beautiful sculptures are made out of sugar. You can make a kind of paste with it and either mold it or shape it into turrets or castles or ships or whatever fancy you might have, mythological animals. And these decorated the tables of the European elite. In Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan really loved sugar sculptures, and he would every year have a sugar procession in which hundreds of janissaries would carry beautiful sculptures for the pleasure and delight of the Sultan. Today, sugar is being used in 3D printing to make some really interesting sculptures, and there are some new kinds of uses in what I guess I would call bio-couture, where they're making fabric from lightly sweetened green tea that they allow some bacteria to grow on, and it turns into a kind of solid sheet, and then they dry it, and they can actually stitch it, and you can wear your sugar.
We're talking about all things sweet, the history, the culture, and the dark side of sugar. And we'd like to hear about your relationship with sugar. Do you have a favorite sugar fix? Maybe there's a strong cultural connection for you with sugar, or do you have a love-hate relationship with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation with food writer Dara Goldstein, who edited the new Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets.
We're talking about sugar, its history, its culture, and more. And you can join the conversation. Why are sugar and sweets so alluring, if not addictive? And maybe you have a memory of a favorite childhood treat, maybe a guilty pleasure. Or do you think that sugar does more harm than it does good? And what healthy alternatives have you found? You can call us with your questions about the history of sugar, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Food writer Dara Goldstein stays with us. She is the editor of the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets. Now, Dara, how do you approach sugar now after doing this project? Because on one hand, yummy treats. On the other hand, a lot of downside in health and humanity here. What is your relationship with sugar after this project is done?
I have quite a sweet tooth, but now I can't sort of unequivocally look at pastry the way I once did because I have all of these other thoughts in my head. I still enjoy the artistry. I think there are so many extraordinary culinary creations that have come out of working with this amazing substance that is sugar. And I basically approach it the way I do most things in my life, that it's important to indulge and give oneself pleasure. But to remember that life isn't entirely about constant indulgence, and that's how you have to find the balance.
Now, there's a cultural link with sugar, and if you look at, say, literature, children's literature and childhood in general seem to have a close association with sugar, which is it's a difficult thing now. But do you know anything about how that association between sweet stuff, sugar and spice and everything nice, in childhood came to be?
Well, it's interesting. There is an entire entry on sweets and children's literature. I think for many of us, the moment that comes most immediately to mind is the gingerbread house in Hansel and Gretel. But it's very instructive because the children, of course, are drawn to that which they don't have, this amazing, magical house that is made up of all of these delicious flavors, but inside is this witch. So it's a very cautionary tale. And Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is another one where it's all about fantasy and the things that you can't get. So I think it is allowing children to soar in their imaginations, but usually at the end, there's a way in which they're brought back to reality.
We're taking your calls and questions about sugar, sweetness, and our relationship to them. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page where we heard from Brad. Brad says, when it comes to sugar, I avoid it and don't really miss it. My tongue is super sensitive to sugar now. A sweet potato, plain, tastes very sweet now. Sugar, not fat, contributes most to obesity and heart disease, Brad says. And I can kind of relate. As you know, Veronica, I love my daily cookie. But, things like carrots, if I put those in a smoothie or just cook them just right, there's a lot of super sweet food out there without going to some kind of pastry or cookie or something like that. Can we train our palates to get more out of less unhealthy stuff, Dara?
Absolutely. I really think it's in the past 50 to 60 years that the American palate has been pretty much destroyed by having so much additional sugar put into refined foods. So if you go for those ripe, and the problem is that so many of the fruits that we get are not fully ripe if you're buying them at the grocery store. But if you taste these beautiful fruits and vegetables that come right out of the ground when they're fresh, they're extraordinary and they don't need anything else. But your caller's comment made me think of one very interesting little tidbit that I learned from putting together this volume, and that is that in Germany they're doing experiments with cockroaches, trying to attract them and then poison them, obviously because no one likes cockroaches. So they used a sugar solution. But what they found is that within 5 years, which is roughly 25 generations of cockroaches, they're losing their taste for the sweet because they are understanding that it is tainted with poison. So if you take the cockroach as an example, we can lose our sweet tooth too.
If we keep poisoning ourselves, I don't know if that's a good trade-off.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, in a way we are, just from the ubiquity of sugar in our food system.
So maybe 5 generations from now, Americans will be eating
right.
That sugar? I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I have heard anecdotally that American sweets are very, very sweet. And I've heard the same thing about other cultures, but that if you look, say, at the patisserie of France, that there's not really as much sugar in what we consider their sweets. Are there cultural differences in what a culture considers sweet?
Yes. And there are individual differences, too. I mean, everyone tastes differently. And once again, I think that the American palate has grown progressively more attuned to the sweet. Certainly in our candies and our chocolate, it's only, I think, fairly recently that as a country in general, we're starting to understand how beautiful a very dark and bitter sweet chocolate is. One of the things about sweets is that they will taste best when you add some salt to them because that enhances the flavor. So that is one reason why you see things like salted caramel, and then you get some nuance and some complexity, and it's not simply just sweetness.
We heard from Carlos in Madison called, couldn't stay on the line, bringing up the connection between our sugar consumption and diabetes. We've alluded to some of the health problems, but lately we hear phrases like diabetes epidemic in the United States. I mean, is that the end result of our love of sugar, our mass production of refined sugar?
Unfortunately, I think it is. Again, I want to stress that I think the problem lies in processed foods and how many added sugars and the fact that they're very refined sugars. So if we decide that we want something sweet or we bake something at home and it has some sugar in it, that's not the problem. It's the amount of high fructose corn syrup, for instance, that sneaks into all kinds of food that is very common in the American marketplace, and people aren't really aware of how much sugar they're eating.
You're talking things like ketchup there and spaghetti sauce, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but even, I think the two huge culprits in American life are children's breakfast cereals, which are enormously sweet and marketed in a way to appeal to children, and then also sodas, which, as we know, they were once made with cane sugar. And if you go to other parts of the world, they're still made with cane sugar, things like Coca-Cola are, and they have this lovely flavor. But the processing changed here because it's cheaper now. So that's really, I think, where the problem is.
And just very briefly, as we wrap up, Dara, you've written this entire compendium on sugar and some of the glories along with some of the low points. I mean, would you want to live in a world completely without sugar?
Oh, never, never, never. sugar is a beautiful thing. It is just that when it's abused, like anything else, it can be dangerous. But I guess I would encourage listeners to think about all of the extraordinary works of art that have been created that show still life with all kinds of dessert tables, or chocolate being used as a medium by an artist like Ed Ruscha, or some of the dresses that they make for the Salon du Chocolat that are quite whimsical and wonderful, and the songs, all of the songs that have sweets in it.
We'll leave it there, Dara. Thanks for being with us today. That was food writer Dara Goldstein. Her new book, she edited the Oxford Companion to Sugar and Sweets.